President Obama, of course, giving his State of the Union address last night, a sweeping hour-long presentation, heavy on business, a pinch of emotion in there as well, with some talk about gun law reform. But ultimately, as we do at Yahoo Finance, we like to focus on the economic and business story. And we're lucky here at the White House today to be joined by Alan Krueger. He's the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. He's given us a half an hour of his time. So tweet your questions in at hashtag SOTU or WHChat or YFinSOTU. If you got all that, you're smarter than me. Alan, thanks so much for coming on. I think, and it's so fitting to have you because you've written for years about the benefits and lobbied strongly for raising the minimum wage. The president has targeted $9 an hour by 2015. How is this going to actually come to be?
Well, what we've seen in the past is when we've had minimum wage increases, lower wage workers finally get a leg up in the job market. They benefit. They tend to be more productive. They also tend to be less likely to leave their jobs, lowers turnover. They have more money in their pockets. That helps businesses. So all of that helps the economy. And I think people have come to recognize that. I think that's why there's so much support for the minimum wage.
And on the flip side, there's worries about job destruction rather than job creation, which is certainly a prominent goal of the administration.
Well, what we've seen historically is that minimum wage increases are not accompanied by job losses. That's what most of the evidence shows. Most of the careful studies that look, for example, when a state like Washington State or New York or California raises their minimum wage, look right across the border at other states which have a lower minimum wage. You see the state that raised the minimum wage doesn't do worse in terms of job growth, but their workers do get a wage increase, and that, as I said, gives consumers more money in their pockets, and that's something we need right now because aggregate demand has been pretty low in this recovery.
The numbers I hear is that something in the order of maybe 5 million workers would be affected by this by 2015. Does that sound about right?
No, I think it'd be considerably higher.
More than that?
It would be more than that based on the calculations that I've seen.
What about on businesses? What kind of feedback did you get prior to actually saying, let's go for this?
You know, we've looked at what businesses have said in the past, what their experiences have been, for many of them, the vast majority, from what I can tell, it's been a manageable policy. And you know, just bear in mind, this is returning the minimum wage after inflation to where it was in 1981. So this is not out of the bounds of something that we've seen in our country before. In fact, inflation eroded the value of the minimum wage in the 1980s, and that is when we saw a very big rise in inequality in the U.S. when low-wage workers did particularly poorly. So this restores the value of the minimum wage back to where it was when President Reagan came to office.
So you think this will actually ultimately create jobs?
No, I think it's good for the economy. Economists debate whether there's a small effect one way or the other in terms of total jobs. I think the key thing, the thing to keep one's eye focused on, is that this will raise incomes for the lowest paid members of our society. And the president made very clear last night, he doesn't think anyone who worked full-time year-round in America should have to raise their family in poverty. This is a very big step in that direction to satisfy that principle.
And, you know, I heard that, and that's a laudable and a noble statement. But, you know, as it stands today, at $7.25 an hour, if you work 40-hour week, 52 weeks a year, you make $15,000 a year. The federal poverty guidelines for next year, for this year, are $11,490 for $15,000. So even at, you're still within the poverty guidelines. So technically you're not there. If you go to $9 an hour, you're up to almost $19,000. So you're well and above, unless you get up to, and you start adding kids into the equation.
Well, you know, the poverty line for a family of four, a husband and wife, two kids, is about $23,000.
Right.
If you had a $9 an hour minimum wage, you'd have a family making $18,000, $19,000 a year with one worker working year
single,
round.
Single income,
wage.
Right.
That's right. Well, somebody often has to take care of household responsibilities or maybe going to school to try to improve their skills. But then also you add in the important tax credits that we have, and that brings family above the poverty line with the earned income tax credit, child credit, these important credits that have historically had bipartisan support.
Some people have written in asking, why $9? Is it the Goldilocks number? Is 10 too much to stomach? Eight? I mean, I know there's going to be a gradual process to get to 9. Why 9?
Well, as I said, the president stated as his goal that a family that's working at the minimum wage should be able to make enough money so that they can raise their family in dignity above the poverty line, and that would do it.
Okay, let's kind of segue. I want to wrap it up with the minimum wage, and get into sort of the whole headwind conversation. There's been a lot of talk about fear of headwinds with the sequester cuts coming on, and that we don't want to do anything to this economy that would, you know, further weaken things. Is not a minimum wage increase a headwind for business?
I don't think that's right when you look at the totality of the effect the minimum wage would have. As the president said last night, an increase in the minimum wage would put more money in people's pockets that will help businesses to see more customers. So I think when you look at the totality, it's something which makes our economy more fair, has a beneficial effect on the economy.
And do you see this happening by executive order? I mean, the actual implementation, how does this become the law rather than just a presidential idea?
Well, of course, the president needs to work with Congress to pass an increase in the minimum wage, and that's what the president intends to do.
Confident. Good. All right, let's go on and talk about some of the other headwinds, because there's lots of discussion lately, of course, about these sequester cuts and how much tax reform or revenue increases versus how much cutting. What's the ideal ratio that you're looking for of the cut to revenue? What's the perfect match?
You know, when the president campaigned, he was very clear with the American people. We need to get on a fiscally responsible path. The budget was on an unsustainable course because we had two wars that we didn't pay for, because prescription drugs provided by the previous administration unpaid for, because of tax cuts, which we couldn't afford. And then on top of that, the recession made things even worse. What the president has been committed to is a balanced approach between additional revenues and smart spending cut.
50-50 balance?
Well, what he said, he was very clear in the campaign. He said $2, $2.50 in spending cuts for every dollar of additional revenue. That's what we've kept to so far. And I think it's important to bear in mind, as the president emphasized last night, we've made major progress. We've reduced the deficit over the next 10 years by $2.5 trillion. And that is mostly by spending cuts. We are raising about $600 billion, a little more than that, in higher tax revenue paid for by the top 2%. And the rest is all because of spending cuts that were part of the Budget Control Act and part of other steps that were taken previously.
If you take a look at, again, to use the term headwinds, is $1 trillion of cuts as much of a headwind as $1 trillion in tax increases? Or how are they not the same degree of a headwind?
Well, I think what most economists would tell you is that you want to make cuts to activities that don't yield the highest return, and you want to preserve the headroom in your budget so that you can invest in things that are critical to the American people, critical to our economy going forward, like research and development and education, and preschool education, which the president emphasized last night. One of the key elements here is the timing. The economy is still in a position where it could continue to use some help. Aggregate demand has been relatively weak. That's mainly because so much wealth was destroyed by the recession. So that's at a time when I think you don't want to cut back too sharply in terms of government support for the economy. What the president has proposed is a very responsible, balanced path where we invest more in the near term, doing things like investing more in infrastructure. Mm-hmm. He emphasized last night a fixed it first approach, where we would invest in our roads and our highways, put more construction workers back to work, raise productivity in the future. That'll attract more companies to the U.S. And at the same time, make some of the difficult decisions on entitlements, which will help to get us on a more sustainable path.
I just want to reintroduce ourselves if people are just tuning in. I'm at the White House with Alan Krueger. He is the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, and we're going through the economic points, many of them that were made by President Obama last night in the State of the Union address in the special live events being carried on Yahoo Finance. So Professor Krueger, we continue. You mentioned manufacturing. The president, as we speak, more or less, is in North Carolina touring a manufacturing facility. There's been a big push to get those jobs back onshore. We've seen some companies saying they would do it, and even some foreign companies building facilities here. What is the president's Manufacturing Institute's idea? How does that create these coveted jobs?
The president has a really ambitious, broad approach to try to revive manufacturing, and I would say build on the revival that's taking place in manufacturing, as we've added 500,000 jobs in the last few years after shedding manufacturing jobs for a decade. One important element of it is the Institutes of Manufacturing Innovation. I think of this as being multiple Bell Labs. Remember Bell Labs? That's where the transistor came from. We wouldn't have transistor radios. We probably wouldn't even have laptops if it weren't for Bell Labs today. Communication satellites came from Bell Labs, a whole bunch of spillovers. So the president has already launched one of these institutes in Youngstown, Ohio, where a former shuttered plant is now being used for three-dimensional printing. And the idea is to enlist the best researchers we have in an area, community colleges to help train workers to do advanced manufacturing, and to work with entrepreneurs in the area to spur economic growth.
One area of manufacturing, it's perhaps a hybrid, would be the energy infrastructure manufacturing industry. I mean, it's an industry in and of itself, but it's also, there's a lot of hardware, so to speak. The president doubling down on the renewable energy call. Again, this is one of those things where cheap energy fuels growth, where everyone loves the idea of clean energy and renewable energy, but there is a cost to it. Is this the time to be making those sorts of investments that are costly?
This is the time to be making smart investments, absolutely. We're going to maintain our leadership in the world by making smart investments. We don't want countries like China to get ahead of us when it comes to renewable energy sources, manufacturing devices, and so on. And this really hits the sweet spots in many ways. Obviously, it's helpful for the climate if we're using renewable energy sources and reducing our carbon footprint. It helps to create jobs for American workers. It helps to lower costs for other industries that use energy, and not only manufacturing, although manufacturing is one, but certainly service sector uses quite a bit of energy as well.
And you think, again, this is something where short term there's a cost in it, but it's justifiable for the longer term greater good.
I think you have to look at the whole package. And the proposals the president made last night are not going to add to our deficit. He's staying within the agreed upon limits from the Budget Control Act. So what's very important is that we support the economy in the short run and make the necessary steps to rein our healthcare spending under control and to get our deficit under control in the intermediate and longer term.
How is that possible? How can you add on all kinds of different spending initiatives? What's being cut to add, as the president said, not one dime to the deficit?
Well, you know, the president in his negotiations with the Congress offered to reduce Medicare spending by $400 billion, a very painful thing for him to have offered. But he thought it was in the country's interest and in the interest of trying to get to a deal. So the president has, I think, made clear that he's willing to do the difficult spending cuts in order to preserve room so we can make the investments that will make our country stronger.
One of those investments, you mentioned it briefly, was the preschool initiative for basically four-year-olds of low and poverty-level income families to have school starting from the age of four. Estimates are somewhere north of 100, 200, I don't know how many hundred thousands of teachers would need to be hired to do that. Again, that is not cheap.
Well, what the president proposed is preschool education for all. And what a volume of research has found, looking at the Perry preschool experiment, the Apsidarian experiment in North Carolina, actual programs that have been put in places like Georgia, what all of that experience points to is a very high return to these kinds of investments. High return for society, high return for the children going through the programs. And I'm not going to jump ahead of the president's detailed proposal about how we'll do this, but those details will come out later on.
Speaker Boehner had said if government spending led to prosperity, then the economy would be booming right now. This is a prime example where nobody would argue the merits of education for kids, particularly needy kids. But they would argue that maybe this isn't the time that we can spend on it?
You know, we need to spend smartly. And we had this horrible recession because we had a financial sector that was not adequately regulated. We weren't making the smart investments over the previous decade. And that's frankly what led to many of the economic problems that we're now facing. So we need a smarter government, not a bigger government, but a smarter government, as the president made clear last night.
Do you think you said bigger government, I jump right on it. Do you think that we are going to be a smaller government ever, or are we just going to grow into the government that we've created right now with these deficits?
You know, the deficit's been coming down. I think what it's important not to lose sight of is we've reduced the deficit from 10.1% of GDP in 2009 to 7% last year. That's actually the biggest drop since the end of World War II. And the Congressional Budget Office projects that it's going to come down at just as quick a pace this coming year. So we are bringing the deficit down. What's important is that we make the steps so that we get the deficit under control in the intermediate and the out years, and that we preserve the room in our budget so that we can make the critical investments that will make us a stronger economy.
Sure, but that shrinking of the deficit is mostly the result of an improving economy and tax base, not a result of shrinking top line.
No, it's a mixture of things.
There
have been cuts and also additional revenue raised by the American Taxpayer Relief Act, which preserved the tax cuts for the middle class families, but raised over $600 billion in additional revenue from the top 2%. So it's been a combination of things. Another example is the expiration of the payroll tax cut. The 2% payroll tax cut expired. So it's been a mixture of policy changes as well as improvements in the economy that have helped to bring the deficit down.
And that was a gamble, the payroll. That was something that the Obama administration did not want to do, is to have that hit particularly, I mean, all taxpayers, particularly low income and those below the 250,000 level, the 2%.
If you go back to the history of the payroll tax cut, the president fought hard for the 2% payroll tax cut. I remember Christmas before last, President postponed his vacation because he wanted Congress to extend the payroll tax cut at that time. It was in place for 2 years. It provided critical support for the economy when we were facing headwinds from spikes in gasoline prices and from drought in the Midwest, from problems in Europe and in our trading partners. So the payroll tax cut did provide critical relief for the economy. You know, that is one of the headwinds that we're going to face going forward. So it's important that we continue providing the support that is sensible to provide for the economy while we're making the steps to get on a fiscally responsible path.
Jeff Sessions, Alabama Senator, Republican Senator Jeff Sessions, said that this government, this administration is creating a culture of dependency and poverty. And he's saying that we need to measure how many people we help up, not how much money we spend trying to help people.
Well, first of all, just look, over the last 35 months, we've added over 6 million private sector jobs. The economy is expanding. The president was very clear last night about how he wanted to provide more ladders of opportunity, wants to reward work, wants people to get a decent wage for their hard work. That's one of the reasons why he supported a higher minimum wage. So I think the proper interpretation is the president is doing everything in his power to expand the middle class. And I think we're seeing the economy beginning to recover. It's not recovered, but it's been healing as a result of the efforts this president has taken.
Just to be clear, how do you define middle class? It's a term that's overused, I think you agree.
I think that's right, and I think in America we think about the broad middle class, and I think that's very important. I could tell you as an economist, we look at certain statistics. One is called kurtosis, which is a measure of how skewed a distribution is, or how thick the tails are in a distribution. And what we've been seeing in the U.S. is we're becoming much, much more polarized, and that's not good for our economy. And the president last night emphasized the way you grow in an economy, the way we became the strongest economy in the world, is from the middle out, not from the top down. And that you see reflected in his proposals last night. You see that reflected in his fighting for the extension of the tax cuts for the vast majority of Americans, but allowing the tax rates to go back up on the highest income earners. You see that reflected in his support for universal pre-K education. So the president is committed to the idea of trying to expand the middle class, give people a leg up who are trying to get into the middle class.
So this is not a really a number per se that of the family of four. I mean, we hit it on the poverty line, on the minimum wage. You know, we have our targets there, but you don't really have a middle class range per se that you work around.
There are many definitions of the middle class, and you would apply them in different situations. But I think we could say without hesitation that the statistics we have show that the middle class has been under stress over the last 30 years. We've been becoming more polarized as a nation in terms of incomes, and that's not good for our economy going forward. It's not good for our country going forward.
Okay. We talked about preschool and the investment that is being proposed to be made there. Another area is the sort of refurbishment of the country's highways, 70,000 bridges, for example, $50 billion in public works. It has a familiar ring to it for people that would remember the first days of President Obama in office, but shovel ready didn't turn out to be so ready. Is this going to be different, or I should say, how will things be different this time? How can this presidential proposal actually put shovels in the ground and projects get them underway?
We have a long-term need to improve and upgrade our infrastructure. The president's proposal last night is for fix it first. That's an area where you tend to think there are immediate needs. It's not building bridges to nowhere. It's fixing the bridges that we have, which are essential for our commerce, essential for our public to commute to work, for them to go on vacation, visit family. This used to be a bipartisan issue. What seems to have changed is that only the Democrats now support it. But it used to be viewed that improving our infrastructure is in our nation's interest. I can tell you as an economist, it has a very high return. Ned Gramlich, who was an economist at University of Michigan and then later on the Federal Reserve Board, concluded that investing in maintenance for existing infrastructure has the highest return. Mm. So I think it's pretty clear that those are the kinds of investments that will put more people back to work today and strengthen our economy and our country in the future.
Yeah. Well, I think where people separate is, high-speed rail lines and rural California and bike paths versus, a rusty bridge over a major interstate.
Well, we need investment in lots of different types of infrastructure in the U.S. The president quoted last night the CEO of Siemens Corporation, who said that he would bring more jobs to America if our infrastructure were upgraded. So in different areas, the needs are different. But I think there's no doubt that we have a lot of scope for improving our infrastructure, which will help to build our economy.
This is like self-interviewing. This is great because you bring up Siemens immediately. I think of the push for a European trade pact, a German giant. It's a company that obviously has vested interests here, has people here on the ground already, but they want to add. How specifically would you get a trade agreement through with the Europeans? They're not the easiest to deal with on a regulatory basis.
Well, that's why we have the U.S. Trade Representative. Yeah. That's why we have a State Department. There are many agencies within the U.S. government that will be involved in those negotiations.
I mean, it seems more like a goal than an actual plan. It's an ongoing thing to improve relations with Europe. It's one of our best and most important trading partners.
No, I don't think that's a fair description. This is a serious effort to strengthen trade ties, to increase the amount of exports that we send to Europe, particularly, I would say, in the area of services where we have a big surplus when it comes to exports, and that'll create more jobs for Americans. That's the goal.
Rand Paul, in his rebuttal, had said, or at some point in the past 24 hours, has said that we possibly need as much as $4 trillion in budget cuts, not a trillion or a trillion two.
What the nonpartisan or bipartisan Bowles-Simpson Commission said, what a number of other commissions have said, what independent economists have said, is that over a 10-year period, we need to reduce our deficit by about $4 trillion. Bowles-Simpson suggested doing that in a balanced way. That's very much in the president's spirit. We have already reduced the deficit by $2.5 trillion over that period. That's a very big bite. That's over halfway there. We could get the rest of the way, but we need to do it in a balanced way. And we certainly need to make sure we avoid self-inflicted wounds. something like the sequester, which would cause, as the president said last night, hundreds of thousands of lost jobs, is not something we need to be facing right now. We don't need to manufacture crises to address our longstanding budget issues. We can address it without having these manufactured crises, which can do real damage for our economy.
I had a well-known five-star fund manager on our program just this week, and he had said, we're probably headed to recession. We might be there already. We had one negative print recently with the fourth quarter GDP. Do you see a recession coming? The sequester cuts, if they go through, would officially push us into recession. Do you feel that's going to happen?
You know, I think our economy is continuing to heal. I think the data that have come in since the end of last quarter have suggested that exports were stronger than people had built into the fourth quarter GDP numbers. So I would wait until you see the new revision at the end of the month before making a judgment about last quarter. I think as long as we don't get in the way of this recovery, it'll continue. We do know that the sequester would slow down the economy. There's no question about that, not only in defense, but also in non-defense.
And if we get in the way of this recovery by putting in this one-tenth of $1.2 trillion worth of cuts automatically, recession?
You know,
you've been saying that the administration, any number of people have been saying, very bad, wrong time, would be serious, serious problem. So.
And that's all true, and I don't want to get into how deep at the moment, but we can certainly say it's a step in the wrong direction at the wrong time. That's what independent economists say, and it's unnecessary. It's just a manufactured crisis, and the president has proposed a balanced way out of this on multiple occasions, and he continues to try to work with Congress to solve this problem.
But this is where, you know, we're kind of going full circle here, where I get into that, you know, your headwind versus my headwind versus their headwind. All of these different drags, all of these different issues, whether they're cuts or tax increases, are they not equivalent? Are they not all headwinds?
Well, first of all, we don't need headwinds that we can avoid. So that's why I think it's so important that we address this sequester in a responsible way. And we are starting to get some tailwinds. We're beginning to see the housing sector turn a corner. Nationwide, home prices have grown for the first time in over 5 years. We're seeing more home construction. So what we want to do is avoid the headwinds that we can avoid and continue to build on the strength, the natural healing that's been taking place in the economy.
So are you confident that there'll be a last-minute deal and that cooler heads will prevail and that the cuts will be kicked down the road, to use a tired term?
You know, my job is to study the economy.
That's good.
President on the economy, I leave the political prognostication to forecasting to others.
All right. Well, let's forecast about immigration reform, because this is a hot topic and it has some bipartisan support. The president says now, and that sounds good, but it always seems to get stuck up on the details. How is he going to make this happen?
I think we do have a unique moment for comprehensive immigration reform.
No question.
And I think from a number of perspectives, you see a number of interest groups behind it, because it would be good for the economy and good for the country. Taking 11 million people out of the shadows, giving them a pathway to citizenship, not where they get to the front of the line, but they get to the back of the line. But that would be good for our employers. That'll be good for American workers, who will be competing now on a more level playing field with workers who would be much harder to exploit. Trying to retain some of the best minds that come here, especially in the STEM fields, in science, technology, mm-hmm. engineering, and mathematics, making it easier for them to stay here. It makes no sense for us to educate the best and the brightest and then send them to other countries to go compete with us,
sure.
when they could create jobs here.
Well, it's often said more taxpayers rather than more taxes, and you know, presumably there would be some degree of increase in the tax base if we got these people officially on the rolls, so to speak.
There's also a fiscal benefit. The National Research Council did a major study in the late 1990s, and they found that immigrants tend to reduce our deficit, because oftentimes they come here with some education, so we're not paying for their education level. They contribute to our Social Security and Medicare programs. They tend to be younger. They add dynamism to the economy.
No question about it. Well, it certainly was a good conversation. Really appreciate your time and the White House for having us here. Alan Krueger, Chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. Professor Krueger, we should call you. Thank you very much.
Alan works.
Alan works too. Yes, you do, obviously. Folks, this has been a special live presentation of Yahoo Finance, following up on the State of the Union. Appreciate all your thoughts and feedback. Reach out to us in the comment section. You can reach out to us on Twitter or check us out on our Facebook page.